You are listening to the Punk News Podcast, and today it is the diabolical duo, John G and M Moore. M Moore, what's happening? Oh, it was just you and me last week, wasn't it?
It was, back to back.
Oh, wow. Back in action. M Moore, are you sick of me yet? Are you tired of having to talk to me when you could be talking to our other delightful podcast hosts?
No, not at all. I'm more like with it this week, so I'm good.
Wait, no, what do you mean you're more with it? In the case of listeners don't know, last week I literally passed out 10 minutes before the podcast and woke up 40 minutes after we're supposed to start. So how is it that you're more with it than me? How is it that you're the one that's more with it as opposed to me that's more with it and more? Explain that.
I watch Saw and Logs. I'm ready for action.
And Moore is just referencing the fact that she watched the lumberjack competition and she was thrilled and excited and wants to become a lumberjack. But listen,
hey ho,
no time to talk about lumberjacks this week. We've got some interesting news to talk about. So I guess I'll just get right into it. I had a couple of, and Moore, here's a funny story. So yet again, I was selling records down in Wilmington. We worked in Wilmington, Delaware. And there was a young girl buying records from me. She was probably about 22, 21, something like that. Pretty young. And she was talking about like punk rock and stuff. I'm like, she was just getting into punk rock. And she bought a Forward record for me. Forward is a modern Japanese hardcore band. That's a lot like Gauze, but newer. And she was buying it. And then this dude comes up to the table. And more, I knew this dude was bad news from the start. News from the start. And honestly, I judged the guy on his appearance, which is probably a lame thing to do, but it was right. The dude was wearing like dirty sweatpants, like a jacket that like didn't go with the sweatpants. You know what I mean?
Oh,
he was an older dude. He was balding. He had a neck beard. And of all things, he had on the thing that is the red flag of all red flags. He had on a goofy hat. And anytime someone's wearing a goofy hat, you know they're going to be goofy. You know what I mean?
And so, like, what is it? Is it like a top hat? Is it like a bucket hat? Like, is it like Viking horns? Like, what is this hat?
You know, in Canada, you guys wear like those hats with the ear flaps. You know what I mean?
Oh, I love those hats. Yeah.
Kind of like the Uncle Buck hat, or not Uncle Buck. In Christmas Family, Lampoon Christmas Family Vacation, Randy Quaid.
The Eddie hat.
Yeah, it was kind of like that, but like not as like well done. And it was not nearly cold enough to warrant such a big hat. You know what I mean?
I see. Okay.
And the guy had the glasses on. The glasses were fogged up. I'm like, this dude is trouble. I know this dude is trouble. This dude comes up. And he's like, do you have the Pink Steely Dan record? And what he's referring – I know what he's referring to, a very obscure press of a Pink Steely Dan album. And it's like $300. I'm like – and I'm thinking to myself, like, that's like me walking up to, like, someone to say, oh, do you have a test press of Damaged? It's like, no, it's got a test press of Damaged. So I'm like, no, I got other Steely Dan, but I don't have that one. And he's like, well, what Steely Dan do you have? I'm like, I got most of them. You can go through them. And I could see where this was going. So he's flipping through them, and he's looking at him, and he's smiling. I knew where it was going. I'm like, please don't go there. Please don't go there. I'm thinking, don't go there. And, of course, the guy goes there. He goes, do you know where the name Steely Dan comes from?
No.
And I'm like, how can I defuse this? I'm like, yes, I do. And he's like, are you sure? And I'm like, the girl doesn't know anything about Steely Dan. And Moore, do you know where the name Steely Dan comes from?
I think I know.
If the listeners don't know, the name comes from a vibrator. And there's this girl there, and you know, she's like, you know, and the fact of the matter is, like, the dude was creepy looking and greasy looking. Anyway, so he did a weird thing that some people do, like, pick up every record, every Steely Dan record, and look at them and put them back and pick them up and then, like, agonize over them. And eventually he bought Steely Dan's Greatest Hits, which I thought was weird because he asked me for, like, it's like I walked up for, like, the test press of Damage and then just walked away with a new copy of First 4 Years. It's like you're buying the most common one when you ask and he's like, I'm buying this for my nephew. I'm like, all right, man. You know what I mean? But the fact is, I mean, M Moore, like, I treated this guy like trash, and I'm not sorry I did to a degree. But it's like if the dude wasn't creepy looking and he asked that question, would I be as skeeved out? Like if it was like a 14-year-old boy, I'd be like, yeah, all right, wise guy. You know what I mean? Or if it was a girl, I'd probably be like, aha. But the fact that it was like this creepy, greasy old dude, like, is it fair for me to castigate this guy and more? Like, two different people have different standards of what things they can say in front of other people. You know what? I thought that, like, yeah, if it was just me and him, so. I would still think it was creepy, but, like, I wouldn't care. But there's just, like, this 22-year-old girl there, you know what I mean? A little skeevy. But if he wasn't as gross looking, I probably wouldn't have been as annoyed. So what's the rule here, Emmore? What's the rule?
Like, yeah. Like,
and doesn't Steely Dan suck? Steely Dan sucks.
Every time I hear Steely Dan, all I think of is the Oh Hello on Broadway, like, Netflix movie that, like, Nick Kroll and John Mulaney did. And, like, halfway through, they're just like, yeah, I like Steely Dan over and over again. And that's all I can think about.
The weird thing is, Steely Dan has had such a renaissance in sales. Funny. Steely Dan records used to be, like, $3 to $5 over the past 2 years. Mm-hmm. Now they're $15, $20. The first Steely Dan record even gets $40 for the first – for Steely Dan! I mean, not even Fleetwood Mac. Steely Dan! Anyway, Emore, was it fair for me to judge this guy based on his creepy hat, greasy clothes, and weird look?
Well, okay. Like, Like, don't judge a book by its cover, all that stuff. But I have been...
See, I think the guy was getting I think he was getting off answering that question in front of the girl. That's what I think. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like that's kind of the thing. Like, okay, that's nice that's your kink, but get consent, you know, before you bring other people into it.
So his kink is walking around asking people about Steely Dan's names?
Yeah. Gives him that buzz.
But I shouldn't complain because, I mean, honestly, the fact of the matter is most people that buy records are actually, like, really cool and fun and good to hang out with. Anyway, let's talk about this week's news, not Steely Dan and creepy old dudes, which are, well, Emore knows how I feel about creepy old dudes, especially creepy old dudes in the punk rock scene. But anyways, be a cool old dude in the punk rock scene, not a creepy dude in the punk rock scene. Anyways, let's talk about some news. Let's see here. Oh, Scal. They announced a new LP. There is a lot to take apart here. The new LP is called, EP. It's got a cool name,
EP.
Psychic Dance Routine. There's, I think, 5 or 6 songs on it. They released a video for opening night. Of course, Scal is one of the big up-and-coming hardcore bands that was kind of blowing the lid off everyone. But now, they're kind of not a hardcore band anymore. Now they're kind of more of an art rock, art punk band because the new track, Opening Night, is really kind of more... 90s alt rock. I mean, it reminded me a whole lot of Hole, reminded me a whole lot of actually No Doubt, the way she, like, the singer Cat Moss performs, but she does, like, freak out at the end. So there's a lot to unpack here. One of the things is it a smart move for Scal to move away from hardcore so quickly and so suddenly? A lot of hardcore bands eventually do wind up feeling trapped by hardcore because it is a very limiting genre. The most famous recent one, well, a couple of famous recent ones, Ceremony put out 3 hardcore records, including the seminal Ronan Park, and then just stopped doing hardcore at all. Fucked Up Fucked Up is probably never going to go back to strictly hardcore, but they still do some hardcore and some art rock and some college rock and that kind of a thing. The classic examples, Black Flag, even though My War and Slip It In are arguably hardcore records, they're not hardcore in the sense that Damaged is hardcore. And so a lot of bands do feel pigeonholed by hardcore because it is such a narrow genre. So the question here is, should Scal have kept doing hardcore, or would they have been trapped? I mean, you could also get trapped in hardcore. Like, you can get to, like if you look at the band like Terror is never going to be anything more than Terror is, you know, because they do tough guy hardcore or toughish guy hardcore. Scal is kind of an artsy band, which is one of the things I like a lot about them. So they've moved away from hardcore. Was that the right move artistically? Well, was it the right move artistically? Was that the right move for them? Was it the right move business-wise? Another question is, their LP was huge in the world of punk rock and hardcore. Is following up with an EP a dangerous move? I would argue it actually might kind of be a dangerous move, to tell you the truth.
Interesting.
And I had one other thing to point out, but I guess we'll start there. Emore, did you dig the song? What do you think of my open-ended questions?
I really like the song. It's very catchy. It's very deceiving, I guess, is the way to put it. Because, like, yeah, it is. It's definitely more alt-rock and stuff, but there are... like, still hints of the hardcore, like, sound in the instruments, and then sort of in Cat Moss's clean vocals, because they did Seeds to Sow on How Flowers Grow, and that kind of started out, you know,
I would argue that Seeds to
like
Grow
that.
is a lot different than this song, though. I
Oh,
would
a
say
hundred
Seeds.
percent.
Oh, okay, yeah.
No, I just think like that the seed of like, oh, we might go in a more like alt-y direction was planted with that song. No, they're completely different. But with this song too, at the end, when like the last like little bit, it's just amazing like hardcore vocals, like just growling and like guttural, and it's harder than some of the stuff on How Flowers Grow. And I love How Flowers Grow, and I love how it sounds on that album, but like holy shit, like it's just like an explosion. So that's kind of what I'm thinking is this they're taking it in a direction that they want to take it, because they do have a bit more creativity, they do have a bit more wiggle room, but when they go like full hardcore, they just hit it, you know, they hit it out of the park without having to like worry about like shredding your voice every night, or having to worry about like you know, the stuff that goes with doing rougher vocals. So like that was something that I thought about it, because like the song is still like it has that power to it. Like they have that momentum, they have that push, they have something very, very unique in bands that like sets them apart, you know, like the it factor. I don't really want to like say that, but you know what I mean. Like you hear a band, you're like, yep, like they 100% have that. So I do think that there's more than meets the eye to it. The video also is really cool, because it's like the band's performing and they're wearing suits, and then Cat Moss is there in like a 60s kind of like dress, and it's black and white, and I think there's flowers on it, and there's like people in the audience watching who have like balaclavas and these like pigtails made out of socks and like ribbons and different things. And like she gets a bloody nose at one point, and then she's like coated in blood, and then the song changes to the hardcore vocal, and it ends with a to be continued. So I want to know what's going to happen next, like in the next video, what direction they're going to take it in. I do have a feeling that the EP is going to balance the alt rock and the hardcore out a little bit more and make it sound better.
What gives you that feeling?
Just an inkling, just an intuition, a gut feeling. But yeah, it still has like that chaotic feeling to it. It's great. Following an LP up with an EP though, that's an interesting
It's well,
that is an interesting thing.
a lot of bands do that. One reason that some bands, well, there's a lot of different reasons that bands do it. One reason that bands do that is because they actually have gotten an offer from a much bigger label, but they've already committed to a record to the other smaller label. So sometimes the smaller label, who are kind of being good guys, can't just let the band go because, they've commit, they've got money invested in them. So like, well, how about just give
Interesting.
us an EP and you can go, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then that's often considered a good workaround solution because it kind of eases fans into a new era of the bands. Another reason is because there's a bunch of like, I mean, it seemed like the record just came out, the old record just came out, but it came out in 2021. It seemed like it just came out, but it didn't.
It did.
So sometimes when a band has momentum, they'll put out an EP to keep the momentum going. My personal opinion is that the EP, though, kind of EPs can be underwhelming. Whereas if you put out an album that just blows people away, like the Scowl record did, it's tough to blow people away with an EP because it's shorter, especially when you have longer songs like this record. So sometimes it can actually cause you to lose momentum. What I would usually suggest, and it's easy for me because, we don't know what's going on behind the scenes or whatnot, you know
Yeah.
what I mean? But what in the scenario, if you're a band and the only factor is if you put out a killer album and people are excited for more material, either put out a single here or there, and that I mean, like eventually put out a single with this with the song on the A side and a couple of cool songs on the B side, that would serve to keep interest going and keep people excited for what the band's up to going forward. Or just I mean, if you don't have enough material to put out an LP, you shouldn't rush out an LP of mediocre material, especially on a second record. Although really, the second record. Well, actually, back in the day, the second record used to be one you could whiff, you know, like the damn second record, not as good as the first. Clash second record, really, really good record, not as good as the first, you know. And then the third record is where you come back and really do the grand slam, you know, damn Machine Gun Etiquette, Clash, London, yeah. Cold. I don't think it's that way, though, anymore, just because, A, records take longer to come out, where records come out every year. Now it's every 2 years or even 3 years. And also people's attention spans are different. So I don't think that's necessarily true anymore. The point being is, if you put out a mega slam first record, I think your second option would be a mega slam as well. I think an EP can be underwhelming, kind of cause you to lose momentum. A great example, I would say, is Catbite's first record was awesome, and their second record was awesome, and they are building. Mm-hmm. Between those records, they put out some interesting singles here and there to keep people interested. So I think that's the way they do it. There's not one magic recipe for success, but I would argue that the EP itself can be dangerous because almost by design, it's saying we don't really want to take a big risk, so we're just going to hedge our bets on this one, you know, smaller thing. So I don't know if that's a great idea, to tell you the truth. But we'll see. I mean, I hope it is for them. I love Scout. The other question I want to ask is, one problem that Ceremony has really dealt with, and they still haven't been able to overcome, even though it's been literally 13 years now, is Ceremony's first three records were all hardcore. After that, it was all post-punk or whatever. Live, they just can't mesh the two sides together. When you go see Ceremony live now, it's like, here's three hardcore songs, blah, 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 blah. And here's a slow song. And everyone just kind of stands around and looks at their feet, you know? Another slow song, you know, two hardcore songs, blah, 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 blah. And then people just got it. So, like, the show doesn't really have flow to it, you know? So I'll be interested to see if Scow can surmount that. I hope they can, because I love them, and I think they'll be able to, but we'll see. So I don't know if you've got any comment on that and more or not.
I think they're going to flow well, because, like, the way that... Like, again, this is making use of hardcore, and it's not like it's a slower song compared to some of the stuff on like How Flowers Grow, but it's not like shoegaze by any stretch of the imagination. You can still like dance and move and like all that to this, and it's going to end on the hardcore note, and that can transition into like Fuck Around and Find Out, or like, you know, something else from like How Flowers Grow, like seamless. I think they're going to do a really good job putting it together live.
They don't really even have that many songs. I mean, like, Scow's in a real cool position where every song they have is a banger. Like, Black Flag, first 4 years, every song's a banger. They only have, like, let's see, 10 songs on the album.
Mm-hmm.
The EP's got 5 songs, and the demo's got, like, 4 or 5 more songs. They got about 20 songs. That's a good amount, actually. But, so, yeah.
Yeah.
Listen, Sisters of Mercy, I didn't even know they were a band still. They're going on tour. Everyone is excited. And more, are you excited to see Sisters of Mercy? Would you go see Sisters of Mercy?
I don't think I'd see Sisters of Mercy. If I had to pay, okay.
What's wrong with you, Em? Why?
Okay, I would go see them if I got in for free, but I wouldn't pay to see them.
Why?
Because I'd rather see Bauhaus.
Well, yeah, of course I'd rather see Bauhaus. That's like saying I'd rather win $1 million instead of winning $100,000. Yeah,
I'd take $100,000.
Do you not like Sisters of Mercy?
I don't mind Sisters of Mercy. Like, I don't know, like, a lot by them. Like, I only know a handful of songs. Like, I like Lucretia, My Reflection, and that's kind of, like, the only song I really know by them. It's just I haven't done a big Sisters of Mercy deep dive. I'm sure that... like, I like that song, so I'm sure that when I do, like, eventually, like, listen to more from them, be like, oh yeah, they'd be pretty cool to see. But yeah, I was surprised that they were still around too, and it's been like 14 years since they toured. I didn't think of that at all. I wonder why they took such a break. What's going on?
I didn't say anything.
You just looked very surprised.
Julian, we've got a surprise from Ivan Julian. Ivan Julian jumping in the podcast right now.
Oh, okay.
And I think Ivan, there he is.
Hold on, video, boom.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, Ivan, how are you?
I'm good.
Ivan, thanks for coming on the show. I appreciate it. So we're joined right here by Ivan Julian, which is a real thrill. Ivan of so many great acts, of Richard Hell and the Voidoids, Ivan of the Foundations. Ivan's got a new solo record out right now. It's called Swing Your Lanterns. I was listening to her earlier today, and Ivan, I gotta say, I really was surprised. Like, this record is so, so good. I think anyone that is a fan of Ivan's work will dig this record. The songs are so well-crafted. Ivan sounds great. His guitar playing is great. And I love on some of the tracks, Ivan will just hit the guitar and there's stuff going on in the background. Then he'll just let the notes of the guitar hang there. And Ivan, the record or the CD is really, really good. It's called Swing Your Lanterns. And Ivan, can we play Cut Me Loose right now? We'll come back and we'll do an interview.
Sure, absolutely.
So this is Cut Me Loose off Ivan's new record called Swing Your Lanterns, out February 19, I believe, next Friday on Pravda Records. And we're back. Ivan, thanks for coming to the show. I appreciate it.
Thank you. You're surprised?
I was surprised at how fresh and classic this album sounds, and that this sounds like someone's first or second record, in that like it's very exciting. It's very, I don't want to say simplified, but every note and every vocal and every line on the album has a purpose. It's written very much as someone that's got something to prove but knows what they're doing. I think it balances those two things very well. I think it's a really cool record.
I appreciate that.
I believe Swing Your Lanterns is the only song that you actually didn't write on this album, correct? You wrote
that's not correct. There's two songs. There's another song called Tell Me Lies that I didn't write as well.
Oh, so what does Swing Your Lanterns mean to you, and why did you choose that as the title of the album?
Well, I recorded that song with my friend who wrote the song, Will Croxton, and it's basically a commentary on, you know, the political climate that we find ourselves in. And, you know, I'd sang the words with him and everything, and he came to me actually and said, you know, while you're making this record, you should put Swing Your Lanterns on the record. And I thought, he says, because you sing it good and everything. So I thought, yeah, why not? And originally the title was going to be I'm Not a Drone Alone of the record. But then I thought, this is coming on so strong, this song, and I wanted it to be the title. So I just made that the title of the record. Thinking that Frank Sinatra didn't write my way either, you know, so it's okay.
Well said. Tell Me Lies, the first track, it's got the lyrics. As I look back through all the years, it seems that troubles followed us from town to town, mile for mile. It's been like this for many days. And if the candles of our love have blown away, once there is passion, now there's only bitter tears, a faded flower turned to gray. Ivan, are you feeling good about things right now? Or are you feeling bad about them? Because the song itself is a fairly bright, energetic track, but the lyrics are rather gray, if you will. How are you feeling yourself right now?
I feel really good right now. I feel good. I mean, you know, I've made this record. I'm healthy, you know, which is a good thing. And I've come to appreciate what healthy means, you know, so, I mean, that's a good thing. But you have to examine your, you know, different pages of your life and different emotions when you're writing songs. And to me, this is a very honest song of someone, you know, laying out their vulnerability, you know, in a relationship, you know.
Fair enough. What do you want listeners to take from this album? For me, well, actually, let me ask you this: is when I was listening to this, I heard many strains of the recordings that you've put in to other records throughout the years. So I guess my question is, maybe I didn't realize the extent to what you've contributed to acts that you've been a part of in the past. Do you feel like you get enough credit? Because I feel like maybe you don't get enough credit. Because like everything in here, I'm like, wow, a lot of this I can trace back to other stuff that people don't say that's Ivan Julian. They'll say, oh, this was band X or this was band Y. I feel like your hand of influence is kind of understated, frankly.
Well, it is. But I mean, you know, being the subject, I can't really focus on that. You know, I mean, I've had experiences, I mean, you know, where, I mean, I've seen it happen. I mean, but I can't focus on that. I know what I did. I mean, I've always said, you know, that this moment would come when people would realize that, you know, my contributions to things and all that. But I'm aware of what I did. You know, I mean, I'm aware I wrote the intro to Blank Generation. You know, I'm aware of a lot of things. I'm aware that, I mean, once there was a paper called, I forget, it was the New Jersey Rock paper. And they reviewed the Voidoid show, and this guy watched me play the solo and then wrote that Quine played it. It's like, so these kind of things have happened. Maybe because he was so much older than me and they expected, like, you know, whatever kind of that kind of thing coming out of someone that was, you know, in their late 20s or 30s as opposed to me being 20 years old. I don't know. I tend not to dwell on it. I just tend to keep, you know, doing what I do, you know.
You mentioned that you've come to appreciate what healthy is or is as right now. I know you had a couple of health scares over the past 5 or 6 years, and I'm happy to see that you've gotten over that. Has that informed your life view at all? Has that informed this record at all?
No. Well, it gave me a sense of, I don't want to use the word urgency, but just purpose to make this record. You know, like, okay, you're better. You can walk around now. What are you going to do with this? You know, what are you going to do with this kind of second newfound, you know, lease on life that you have? You're going to make music, you know, and you're going to make your own music as much as you can, as opposed to producing people and all that. And that's how it affected the record. In terms of my life, I mean, when you come that close to, you know, the edge and you're looking over the cliff, you learn not to take anything for granted. People, you know, just anything, you know, people in your life, you learn to, you know, not take that kind of thing for granted.
Maybe not so much these days, but, you know, even 10 years ago, 15 years ago, people look at punk rock and sort of romanticize self-destruction. A lot of the early punk guys, you know, your contemporaries, you know, died in very self-destructive ways. Yet you're still here making some of the best music you've ever made. What's your opinion of the romanticism of self-destruction, which we often see in like documentaries and movies and that kind of thing, looking back at the early punk scene?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, people that make those documentaries kind of latch onto it because it makes a compelling story. You know, the same thing could be said for, you know, movie stars of the 50s or, you know, rock people from the 60s as well, or jazz people from the 50s, you know, that died like, you know, horrible deaths like Charlie Parker, you know. I mean, but then again, there was a certain sense of a projection of violence in the punk music that kind of made, you know, people kind of once again latch on to that. You see, when you ask me about punk, being SCBGBs at the time, I don't have a definite answer, because what it was all different types of bands from all different types of genres there in the same room, being able to play their own original music. So not everybody was the Dead Boys. Not everybody was, you know, the Ramones. But, you know, the people that write about it like to portray the whole thing that way. I mean, you tell me, what is the musical difference, or similarity, I should say, between Television and Blondie?
What's the musical difference between Television?
No. The similarity. I mean, how are they both punk in a punk rock genre?
Oh, I see. You're making the argument that they're wildly different bands, which I would agree. For
exactly.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, along those lines, if you don't, I'd like to talk about your early history a little bit. I didn't know this until recently. It blew my mind. Is you played guitar or bass, I forget, for the Foundations when, like, right not too long after Build Me Up Buttercup, right?
I played with them about 7 or 8 years after Build Me Up Buttercup. That record came out when I was like 12 years old, and I joined them in England when I was like 19.
So, I mean, was that a formative experience? And my other question, like, with regards to that is, I guess Foundations were kind of a soul rock act as opposed to a soul act. But with guys like the Temptations or the Drifters or the Coasters, when they're on stage, it's very showbiz and there's not a whole lot of spontaneity. So with the Foundations, was that like a lot of fun, or was that like just like cashing a paycheck or work? What was it like playing Build Me Up Buttercup with the Foundations?
Well, it was a song I heard on the radio as a kid, so I was humbled, you know? I mean, along with Baby Now That I Found You and all that. So, I mean, I went from basically living in the suburbs of Maryland to being on stage in England with these guys, who I always believed were from Detroit, and I was shocked to find out that they were all from Barbados and Jamaica and lived in England. And, I mean, but it was far from cashing a paycheck. It was really kind of, you know, rock and roll one-on-one. You know, I mean, it was like kind of really learning the basics of what I needed to do in order to tour, be on stage, play songs, bring the songs to life. But and it was not very spontaneous at all. I mean, because you were expected to play pretty much the same solo every night, and you know, definitely the same part. You know, you couldn't embellish anything, because then, you know, no one would recognize the song. Which I didn't mind, because I was learning. I was, like I said, I was 19, you know.
What's it like when you're standing there on stage and you hear that iconic, why do you build? Like, what's it like hearing that voice? When I hear that song, it sends chills down my spine. Like, what was it like seeing that live time and time again?
Well, the lead singer, Colin, was obsessed with Marvin Gaye. Mm-hmm. That was his idol. He even dressed like him from time to time, you know? And no, it was just, what I was concerned with was coming in with the C chord, you know, when I was supposed to, and then going to the E minor. I mean, I'm glad he's singing over all their nap, but like I said, I was, and I had 1 week to learn their entire set, because I met them at a rehearsal studio where I was trying to find a band in London, where I also met Topper Heaton, by the way. And they said, okay, you know, we don't have a guitar player. We're going out on the road in a week. Here's all the songs, you know, and they, you know, there were no charts or anything. They played them for me and I recorded them into my cassette player, took them back to my flat, and then came in the next day rehearsal and kind of stumbled through everything, you know?
You mentioned Topper, and we'll get to that briefly. I'd like to run through, I'd like to point out to the listeners, and we're going to talk about like the influence and things that Ivan's been involved in, and we'll close up with some more questions about the album, which is Swing Your Lanterns, and I really, really did dig it. So we're going to hit some more of Ivan's history and come back to the present. You mentioned Topper. You were part of, I guess, writing the call-up with the Clash, correct?
It was a jam session. Mm-hmm. It was a jam session. I mean, they, you know, I think Joe started the basic riff on piano, and then somebody joined in on bass. And then I said to Joe, you know, give me your guitar. I'm going to play on this. So I grabbed this Telecaster and we just played that riff with a couple of, and started changing on it for about 20, 25 minutes, believe it or not. And then only, you know, and I went down just to say hello and everything. So I didn't really come there to play. And then it was several months after that, I found out that they had chopped it up and made it into a song. Because that whole session, they basically came to town and camped out at Electric Lady, you know, and just kind of were there every day playing for hours, you know.
You opened for the Clash on one or two tours, and you know, and like I said, what's great about you is you're still here making some great music. A lot of your contemporaries have passed away, and they've sort of been deified. Like people refer to Joe Strummer as Saint Joe. What's it like to see that people you knew as people kind of get blown up into these larger than life icons when you knew that they were just people, not, you know, these giants or whatever?
I was always fascinated the way, especially the American press treated the Clash, you know, as one of the greatest rock and roll bands of all time and all that, because to me, they were just my friends. But it doesn't bother me. And I could see why that happens with Joe, because Joe was a really great guy. I mean, he was really down to earth, you know, when you talk to him. He wasn't at all self-absorbed, you know, and he wrote great songs. So that, you know, it's kind of like almost like a Buddy Holly thing or something. It doesn't bother me when I hear that. I mean, it's almost warranted in a way.
When people think of Ivan and the acts that he's been in, they think of CBGB's New York. But like, as you mentioned, you at least lived in D.C. for a while. I'm just curious, did you ever, like in the early days, ever run into guys like Ian MacKaye or Ted Nicely or any of those D.C. crew? Or is that like or is that a little bit later than from when you went to New York?
Ted Nicely and HR from Bad Brains and I all went to the same high school together.
Okay.
At the same time. It's so weird. I was thinking about this the other day. I hadn't thought about it in years. But yeah, we all went to Central High at the same time. And Ted and I lived together, you know, because he had this house, or his mother had this house, and we all used to hang out there. So Ted and I were really great. I talked to him last week, actually. We were really great friends, you know, and kind of grew up together. And I mean, but the whole scene didn't happen with the Beastie Boys and all that. Not the Beastie Boys, excuse me. But Fugazi and all that, Fugazi. That didn't happen until after I left.
Did you and like Ted and HR ever go to shows, or was that like a little bit before shows started happening down there?
We would go to larger shows like, you know, Zeppelin, whoever came to town, Beck, you know, the Faces, that kind of thing. There was no local scene. Had there been, I might have stayed, you know, because one of the reasons I left was like I didn't see any future there except being in a cover band, which I kind of ended up in. But like I'm with the Foundations, not really. But I mean, you know, there was no future in writing or making records when I was living there.
I believe your father was in the Navy. How do you think being the a military kid influenced your perspective on life and your music and that kind of a thing?
It gave me something very definite to rebel against. I can tell you that much. A whole lifestyle to rebel against, you know, because, I mean, we lived on bases all my early life. And especially when we lived in Cuba, we lived on Guantanamo base. So, it made me understand, you know, what freedom of expression was and what lack of it was as well. That's true for a lot of military kids, I think, you know.
What was Cuba like when you were there? I mean, was it an American base? It was basically like America, or did you interact with the Cuban culture? What was it like when you lived on?
No, unfortunately, it's a base built on a bay, and then around this bay, if you can imagine, like, and it's a kind of crescent or circumference kind of thing, is this fence, and we weren't allowed to interact with the Cubans at all. But there was a gate, and the Cubans were allowed to come into the base and do menial jobs like drive buses and et cetera, and, you know, be nannies and stuff like that. But we weren't allowed to go there. So we had communication with them when, you know, they worked in, you know, on the school bus or, you know, or in your house or something, you know. So, and as a kid, it was paradise, you know. I mean, there's blue skies, a beach. You know, I mean, everything was free. The movies were free. You know, I mean, you didn't have to wear shoes. It was a paradise. I mean, because I was at the age where it was. I understand that people that were in their late teens were having more, you know, problems adjusting to being there, because there was one radio station and it was controlled by the government and controlled by, you know, the Navy. And I remember the only music I remember hearing there is On Top of Old Smokey by Burl Ives.
Yeah.
You know, that's the only song, and that and my father's jazz collection was the only music I heard at the time, you know.
There's a story, I don't know when this happened, if you were in D.C., is you calling the American Nazi headquarters or prank calling them or something? Is that true or is that just a rumor?
Where'd you read that? Yeah, that is true.
Okay. So what's the story behind it, or is it top secret?
I was always doing stuff like that. I mean, you know, because there was, they had a gathering out in one of the suburbs. I think it was somewhere near College Park or something like that. And people, not just people of color, but people like kind of, you know, showed their disdain for them being there. And there was kind of a mini riot going on, you know, and because I used to see these guys, they were dressed in full Nazi regalia, you know, like with the brown shirts and the swastika on their shoulder and everything. You'd see them downtown, like, five blocks from the White House. I mean, they were there because their headquarters was in Arlington, Virginia. So I heard about this riot that went on. So I thought, okay, I'm going to call them up and get their opinion. So I called them up and pretended I was working for my high school paper and said, okay, I've heard about this riot. What actually happened from your perspective? And the thing that really bothered me about it was I heard little kids in the background. And I thought, this is upsetting to me, you know? But I kept in character or whatever, and just got his opinion of the whole thing. And his answer was, well, people saw the swastika and they went crazy. And that's all he had to say about the whole thing, you know? But yeah, I did call them up because, I don't know, should have had better things to do. But I was curious about that because this, and all this kind of, you know, this socio-political thing that was going on in the States was totally new to me as well, because I come from this kind of insular environment being on the base, you know, so I wasn't used to all this confrontation that was happening between people. And I felt like, yeah, why don't I just call them up and see what's going on?
That kind of brings us back to the record, and the record kind of contemplates, you know, I guess conflict and division. There's a track, I Am Not a Drone, which I take as about like kind of being forced into a conformity or being a person, not being who you want to be. So I guess my question is, the state of the world, Ivan, the state of the United States, is it looking good or is it looking bleak?
It's always looked bleak. We keep trying. It's always looked bleak. I mean, and the more you find out, I mean, I have friends who tell me like how, you know, miserable they are. They're not feeling this, they're not feeling this. And I tell them, you know, are there bullet holes in your door? Are there fish swimming in your living room? Shut up. You know, I mean, because there's always something like this happening in the world. I mean, we keep trying. It's one thing I find that's fascinating about the drone aspect. I mean, not the drone on the record, but drones that fly in the sky. They really do make us look like insects that are like, you know, just totally screwing up the earth, you know, just kind of running around doing damage everywhere we go. You know, it's kind of a weird phenomenon.
Well, actually, you kind of bring up maybe my favorite question that I like to ask a lot. Emma Moore's probably sick of this question. Human beings, are they inherently good, inherently bad, or just neutral?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think you can, you know, just divide it into categories like that, good and bad, because there's so much gray area in between. I've met really good people, like inherently good people that, I mean, actually, you know who David Amram is?
I don't think so, no.
He wrote the music for The Manchurian Candidate. He's like this kind of beat poet guy. He's 90-something now. When you meet him, there's something in his spirit that you go, first of all, I'll never live to be 90 because I'm not good enough. I mean, he's just good. You know, some people are just good inherently, and that's some. But as a species, you know, I mean, there's that and the other extreme, of course, as we hear about every day, you know. I mean, and maybe that's how we survive, because if everybody was good and everybody was evil, then I don't know if we would survive as a species or, you know, and then in my, from my perspective as well, I'm always disappointed in human evolution, because I like to think that we would have and have evolved further than we have right now, but I see the same crap happening or worse, you know, I mean, over the decades. So, I mean, that's what I'm most disappointed about, is like how little we've evolved and how pretty much, like as Devo said, we've de-evolved, you know.
I've got a couple last questions about the album. Tell me about I Am Not a Drone. Like that's one of my favorite tracks on the album. I love the chorus. I love how it sounds. What does that song mean to you?
That song is about basically, it's about what we're doing to the earth, you know? I mean, it's about how we're basically destroying our environment. I mean, and I am not a drone means I'm not, you know, just like I'm a drone ant alone. There are many of us, you know? I mean, and if you listen to the words, like down the road, there's Mary and God, she's moving slow. It's about what we're doing to the environment. The glowing piles, if you ever go north of Detroit where they built cars, there are these huge mounds of black coke where they used to, you know, make the steel that are still smoldering to this day. That inspired the song as well. You know, a lot of visions like that are kind of dystopian. It's a dystopian song, you know, and also inspired by a movie, Rollerball.
Oh yeah, Rollerball. Yeah.
You ever
James
seen
Caan, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, James Caan. And like there's a scene where the elite are on this ridge and they're taking flamethrowers and they're blowing up trees. And that just really left a really strong impact on me in a way, just thinking like this had the, how, you know, it's, we have this kind of total disregard and neglect for, you know, what's around us, you know, I mean, and the earth, basically. I mean, without sounding too corny, it's like, and that's kind of what inspired that. And also the fact that, you know, all the warnings that, you know, we're hearing now, I have heard since the 70s or late 60s, you know, about global warming, the greenhouse effect, et cetera, et cetera. People have known this now, but now it's becoming serious, you know? So, I mean, that's one reason I thought, like, I'm going to record the song, I'm going to finish it up, and I'm going to put it on the album. And like I said, it almost became the title song.
I've got one last question for you, then I'm going to see if Em Moore's got some questions. I've just got a couple quick random questions I'd like to hit you with.
Sure.
But again, the listeners definitely should check out Ivan's album, Swing Your Lanterns, out next Friday on Pravda Records. It's really good. And my last question in regards to the album is a rather generic question, but I think it's warrants asking you, like, I can't get over it how good the album sounds, how well written it is, how, like, a lot of the songs have a lot of things happening, but they all fit together. And like I said, I love how Ivan will just let his guitar hang on some songs. I think the writing is fantastic. I think the recording is great. Did you, like, approach this album with, like, a specific plan? Like, this whole album sounds very much like it came to you, you said, I'm going to do XYZ, and then you figured out how to do XYZ. I mean, did it come that way, or how did you approach writing and recording this album is my question.
I selected a group of songs and said, okay, I'm going to try this. I'm going to try to make this an album, because it doesn't always work out that way. Sometimes, you know, the songs come as you're making the record or whatever, and some of them are old, some of them are new, some of them are borrowed, some of them are blue, you know, but they're all recorded on tape, and that's a prerequisite for me.
So this album is analog, not digital recorded.
It's analog and then, of course, made digital, you know, and the pressing process.
I think I made a big difference, honestly. I really do. Maybe that's why it sounds so fantastic.
Yeah, I'm a firm believer in that. And, I mean, I'm a firm believer in it because when I've had other tape machines, 2-inch tape machines, you know. But when I got this one about 3 years ago or so, I also inherited some tapes with it. And I listened to the tapes and I thought, why does it sound so good? What's going on here? You know, I mean, because I've always known that tape sounded good. I just couldn't figure out why. And so then, you know, I'm listening to different microphones because the tapes were used, of course, different microphones that were on it. I listened to the drum overheads. And that's when it came to me. It's the air. The air is not being quantized into ones and zeros. Okay. And with digital recording, it is. The air comes into the, you know, whatever, you know, interface you have. And then that becomes the air, which is everywhere. It's like almost like the extra member of the band. And it's all kind of chopped up and gives you kind of this squeaky sound or something. With tape, that doesn't happen. And it just sounds, you know, it's pleasing to your ears. You can listen to it, especially with headphones on, you know.
Do you, when you say air, do you mean the actual sonic waves, or do you mean the air that isn't part of the actual set, the guitar or the drum that's hitting the microphone?
Isn't actual part of the sonic wave that's hitting the microphone, because that sonic wave is traveling through this atmosphere, okay? So therefore, I mean, even if it's silent and you're listening to it, you can hear that, like, it's not being divided up. It's not being quantized. It's just kind of being smeared over this tape head, which gives it a warmer sound.
I definitely think you're onto something.
You know, it's kind of like if you play something through a boiling water or ice water, it's going to sound different, you know?
I'm sold. I agree. Emma, do you have any questions for Ivan?
Yeah, I have one. So I read that the song "I Can't Help Myself" is inspired by one of Charles Bukowski's stories. So what drew you to that story in particular, and to base a song around kind of his writing?
It's a song from Hot Water Music. I believe it's called 45 to Pay the Rent. I think that was the song, because I just read it, and sometimes this happens to me, and the music just comes in my head. And especially with Bukowski, because he's such a visual writer, you know, and I'm a huge fan of his short stories, because I think he's one of the greatest writers of the 20th century. I really do. And I know a lot of people will argue with me about that. But I mean, he wrote a story called Animal Crackers in My Soup. Have you ever read that?
Yeah.
I cried when I read that story. To me, that's the saddest story I've ever read in my life. You know, this woman's there just trying to take care of these animals, and the townspeople go nuts, and they come in and they kill everything. You know, once again, just like, so his stories leave, his short stories especially leave a real impact on me. You know, I think he's a great writer. So that's what Can't Help Myself. I read the story, and I immediately came up with this, you know, counter narrative, you know, verse or that said pretty much what the story was saying.
Yeah, that's so cool.
Okay, well, there you
go. I'm glad she's a Bukowski fan too. Good to meet another Bukowski fan.
Yes.
Ivan, I don't know if you had a chance to check out any of the news stories that we sent over. Did you have a chance to check those out, or maybe you didn't? It's fine either way.
I did get a chance, actually.
Okay, great. Well, we'll ask you a little bit about them, because I'm definitely interested in your opinion. But let's play another song from Ivan's album. This is Can't Help Myself off Swing Your Lanterns, out next Friday via Pravda Records, and we'll be right back. And we're back. Ivan, I'm just curious, what did you think of the Scowl track? Because both Em and I liked it, that the band used to be a strictly hardcore band, and now they're kind of moving into like alt rock or grunge, or however you want to phrase it. What did you think of the video by that band, Scowl?
I thought it was interesting. It's like, it's really weird, because, you know, punk bands per se, when they're from the West Coast, and especially a place like Santa Cruz, they kind of leave their indelible, like, you know, signature on it somehow. It's you can tell that they're from a place like Santa Cruz, you know? So, I mean, I thought it was interesting as well that they decided to dress like the Specials. Remember the Specials, the ska band?
Sure.
You know, I mean, and I was looking, I enjoyed it. I actually watched another one of their videos as well. I think it was called Santa Cruz, you know? Yes, and which was really interesting, which is because it was cool. She, like, I could indemnify. She, like, goes to use her VCR and then opens it up, and then there's no head there, and she goes someplace and cuts her hand. Yeah. I enjoyed that, but it did. I could tell at first glance it was from the West Coast, and not that that's a bad thing. It's just, you know, it's kind of like, you know, people in New York can never write California Dreaming. It just can't happen for them, you know. Or, you know, Monday or any song like that by the Mamas and the Papas, you know, or like, or any kind of song that's in you know, definitely, you know, being inspired by being on, you know, on the West Coast, which is fine.
And more, a band that we talk about a lot on the punk on the podcast, The Damned, have released a video for their upcoming album. The video is called The Invisible Man. It's off the new album called Darkadelic, which follows Evil Spirits from 2018. And more, did you dig The Invisible Man, and did you dig the video?
I dug the video. I'm wondering, is it based on the book?
I got more the Universal monster thing from it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I was wondering about that. I liked it. I liked it actually. It kind of also reminded me of something that's completely unrelated, which is I recently came across Robert Louis Stevenson's short stories. Have you ever read this bizarre story of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde?
I have. Yes.
Yes.
It's an amazing story, and this video reminded me of that for some reason. Like it kind of the scenario that would be set in, you know.
Ivan, do you have any fun Damned stories? Did you ever play with the Damned or hang out with them or anything like that?
Well, I'll tell you about that in a second. But sure. Yes, I did. But I was also amazed by their tour schedule, Sisters of Mercy, because they're like all over the place. They're going up this coast and then down the coast, and they're going over to Washington and they're coming here.
Yeah.
It's pretty wild, you know? Yeah. The Damned. He isn't in the band anymore, but Rat Scabies stayed at my apartment one night in New York because they didn't have a place to stay. The whole band did actually. And he asked me to get him some pot, some marijuana. And so, you know, I sent someone out to get him some marijuana and came back and rolled a joint for him and gave it to him. And he smoked a couple of hits off the joints and he fell on the floor. He's going, oh, it's too strong. It's too strong. I can't take it. I can't take it. I said, man, your name is Rat Scabies. What are you talking about? I mean, I was... You can't take a joint. Come on. I mean, I understood it actually. I was kind of, you know, making fun of them because, I mean, in England, you know, they don't smoke straight marijuana. They mix it with like tobacco and then put a filter on it. You just don't take marijuana and stick it and roll it up there. It's like, you know, just not done. So when he had straight marijuana, it just kind of threw him for a loop. But yeah, I was, I never forgot that story. I'm like, you're Rat Scabies, get up.
Last story, Teens in Trouble, which is another Bay Area band. They've released a video for Old Starness Cove Road. I guess both Ivan and M, did you guys dig the video? Do you dig the band? Kind of more of a indie rock kind of thing as opposed to a punk thing. But Ivan, what'd you think of Teens in Trouble?
I thought it was pornographic.
In what way?
Do I care to elaborate? Because of all the close-ups of the gear.
Oh.
You know? I mean, I was discussing this with Richard Hell a while ago because, you know, I was showing him this guitar book and he pointed this out to me, how they light everything so it just looks so incredibly sexy, you know, like all the guitars. And when I saw that video of all this gear that I know the names of and love, I'm like, wow. I'm going, my mouth is growing. So yeah, I thought it was a pornographic video. And I like the song.
And I don't know if you can follow up on that. Can you follow up on Ivan's interesting perspective on the video, which I would say is valid?
I can't though. I can't. That's how the video will be known now.
Well, yeah, but like, look, I mean, if you look at it, every like, you know, whatever, in two bars, they're cutting to another close up of gear and it's lighting up really slowly and like they're glistening in all this expensive glory, you know.
Well, there you have it. Ivan, you've been a pleasure and a delight. Thank you for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. It's great to hear some of your stories. And also, once again, I don't want to oversell this because, you know, if you oversell, people get turned off. But Ivan's new CD really is great. I really was enjoying it earlier today. Swing Your Lanterns on Pravda Records out next Friday. Ivan, any closing words or any last thing you want to mention for the listeners?
Well, first of all, I'm wondering where you are.
I'm in Philadelphia and Moore is up in Canada.
Wow, yeah. Cool.
International.
We're not playing anywhere this soon, but I am trying to organize a tour to play both places, you know? Ooh, it's a Trocadero show. Where are you in Canada?
I am just like outside of Toronto.
Just outside Toronto?
Cool. Yeah.
I love Toronto. I love playing Canada. And is the Trocadero still happening in Philadelphia?
Sadly, the Trocadero got closed about 3 years ago. Some people were trying.
That was a great room.
If the listeners don't know, the Trocadero is a very famous Philly music venue that used to be like a what do you call it when the girls dance naked?
It was a burlesque.
Yeah. In the early 1900s, it was a burlesque. It was a beautiful room. People like Peter Murphy used to play there, or Peter Hook, or like acts of that caliber. And it was a great room. It's closed up now. It's sort of been replaced by a place called Union Transfer in Philadelphia.
Oh, I don't want to even fathom to think what that is. Never mind. Kind of like what they've done here. All right, guys. It's really great talking to you, okay?
And Fair enough. Great. Once again, I'm Julian. Thanks again. Nice talking to you.
Okay. Yeah, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
And that was Ivan Julian. And more, yet another classic punk news interview comes to a close yet again. You know, we're just kicking ass, and what can I say?
We are. Yeah. No one can even hold a candle. Come on.
So anyways, that's the Punk News Podcast, and I guess we'll see you next week. I don't got anything else to say. That's what I got to say. You got anything else to say?
Go watch some porn. Bam. By that I mean the Teens in Trouble video.